the network for the AV industry.
What are you listening to?
This
is AV.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Nation.
This is AV Week, episode number 80, recorded Friday, March 1st, 2013. Exterminate.
Ready.
AV Week.
Performing scan.
AV Week.
Online.
This is AV Week. It's time for AV Week, your weekly wrap-up of audiovisual news and information. My name is Tim Albright. I'm your host. Thank you so very much for joining us. With us is George Tucker. He is the engineering coordinator for World Stage. How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. Great to be here.
And also here in 1 or 2 seconds, we're going to grab Harry and Mead and throw him on the line. So this week we're going to talk about why you should or should not put your flat panel above your fireplace. And there are some interesting and very heated opinions about that. How to look for a sound bar and why you might lose your internet if you live in the state of California or some other places as well. Depends on who your ISP is. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about Samsung. A couple different stories here. First one comes from Extreme Tech and the fact that they have their funding an antenna project for wireless. Here's an interesting thing about Samsung is they are, let's say, they've got a whole lot of money and they know where they want to go and they will know what they want to do with it. And the reason it matters for us is because Samsung not only is a huge player in the wireless and the handheld market, but they're also a huge player in the AV market. So, George, is this part of them taking their war chest and maybe expanding technology further? Or is this something where it's a tried and true technology maybe that they're just dumping money into?
Well, I don't think Samsung dumps money into anything just miscellaneously. They're not somebody that Google should be looking out for these days, not just according to me, but the Wall Street Journal and some other business magazines, because they are fast approaching being their own entity and being somebody who could probably leapfrog Google. And I think they could give other people like Intel a run for their money in certain things, especially in the mobile area. This one, though, remember, this graphene-based antenna is for intra-chip communications. This is not for your Wi-Fi and stuff like that. This is for data throughput between chips on a motherboard. So this is a really interesting thing in which they're going to try and make lighter, faster, cooler mobile device communication.
Okay, so this is basically faster, cheaper chipsets for tablets and cell phones. Is that what I'm hearing?
Oh, yeah. And it's something that they can do like in the terahertz range. So you can get a lot of data. Yeah. I figure what is it called? Oh, plasmodic graphene antennas. It almost sounds like a punk band from the 70s.
Everything sounds like a punk band to you.
It's true. I remember those days somewhat. I do.
So the other side of this story is it comes actually from the Post, the Washington Post, how Samsung is cozying up more and more to businesses, and this is on the heels of the Mobile World Congress, which really, side note about that, there have been some pundits who have said the Mobile World Congress is now the new CES, where CES, yeah, you can make the argument that it's kind of run its course, it's not as exciting, this is not where people release their big stuff. They hold it for MWC because the world of technology is ever increasingly becoming the world of mobile. So, George, is this the faster, cheaper, cooler processor going on? That coupled with the fact that Samsung's closing up to more and more businesses, does that give them the edge? Obviously, it's going to give them edge over iPhone. But does it also give them, another weapon in enterprise? Because that's kind of where Microsoft's, that's where they have made their bones.
Well, I think you're definitely right. Yeah, I mean, mobile's the thing, right? It's where everybody's going. We should have seen this a couple of years ago. Korea, South Korea, that is, not the one with Rodman in it right now.
Very Japan, nice.
Japan, right? Oh, the jokes I could do on that one. But we're going to stop. There's a reason that mobile devices in those countries, that was the big push. And everyone's like, oh, why is everyone on those little screens? But that's where the newest thing is. And it makes sense that it would be the new CES because everything's going to be based off of it. All right, that's maybe an overreaching statement.
No.
But damn near it. Damn near it, I got to tell you, because everything these kids today do is based on their mobile devices. I mean, even my own 5- and 8-year-old are, like, attached to their DSs, which can do everything, and they can actually talk to each other over them. They don't want to watch TV. They're going to watch the videos on their iPods that they got for Christmas.
And that's so the thing is you've got an entire generation who would rather do things, whether, you know, they would rather consume media, whether that's for entertainment purposes or news and information gathering,
right,
on a portable device. And you're looking at guys like you and me and the people that we hang out with who, you know, we have a TV in our living room. We have a 13-inch because that's, you know, for a different room, but we have a bigger TV in the living room. That's the centerpiece, as it were, of our entertainment world. Because that's what our parents did, right? I mean, I remember growing up, we had console TVs for crying out loud. I mean, these were pieces of furniture, right? that were nigh on impossible to move when you moved houses. But our kids now are doing exactly what you said, George. They'd rather play on the DS. They'd rather play on the iPod Touch or the tablets. And what's interesting is on more than one occasion, you've got... your kids are, and our kids are about roughly, you know, 6 and 7 and 8 and somewhere in there, mm-hmm. and down to 4. My daughter will watch a show on Nickelodeon. It's a music program called The Fresh Beat Band, and we'll play it, you know, on the DVR or whatever. There has been more times than not where I will go and do something or, you know, cooking dinner or what have you, and you'll come back in the room. The show is still playing on the big screen, right? But the two children are huddled around a tablet of some sort, watching the exact same stupid show on the tablet.
Yeah.
Explain that to me.
Well, you know, it's something I wonder, well, because it's interactive, right?
Okay.
They can do things on the side. There's side channels for that stuff. Now, if you remember, HD was supposed to have this kind of stuff to begin with, the side channels that you would preview stuff and see your weather or when the sports was coming up. You could watch your football game, and on the side, you could look up stats and that kind of stuff, or watch the other games. Not quite picture-in-picture, but it was a side channel. My CB days coming back at me, but that's how I usually described it to people. But it's the interactive thing, that this little thing they can carry around. They control it. They possess it. It doesn't. It's not a monolith talking to them, based on our grandparents' days of this box, and you know, you just watch what they show you. You know, and in addition to that, something struck me about this when I was reading about this graphene plasmatic antenna or something. Did you see the American Experience on PBS about Silicon Valley? It was all about, Bill Noyce, right? Bob Noyce.
Yeah.
And the forming of Intel. He was a former employee at Shockley Transistors, the guy who built the transistor and, you know, improved all these kind of stuff. And they were limiting what he could do. And they got so frustrated even back then that they went out and built their own company and developed that planar process, which became the integrated circuit. I get this feeling, and maybe I'm overstretching again here, but Samsung's not only one of the most popular phones out there and electronics manufacturers at this point, they're really innovating. And they may just take it all over. They may be doing almost the same thing on a corporate level. I suspect they have inside their company these little micro research facilities that are given free rein to do stuff. And they're working, then they're reaching out. If you read the article, they're reaching out to research universities, and they're really expanding this thing out. So I've got high hopes for it. Can you hear it in my voice? Probably.
Yeah. Yeah. And I do too. I mean, that's one of the things that I find so exciting is the fact that here's this really cool, innovative company who is doing all these really great things for one of their core competencies, which is let's be honest, it's mobile. But you know, they're a company, and so they're going to reuse that resource as much as they can, i.e., wait for it for a year maybe, and you're going to see stuff like that start sneaking into your displays and other Samsung products that are, you know, that are AV centric. And the possibilities there is what really gets me, is the fact that you're going to have smarter and smarter displays, more and more capabilities. Everything from, having, you know, an integrated, you know, AMX or Crestron display built into a Samsung. I mean, it could get as crazy as that, because then you could, because suddenly you do have the processing power for that, right? You don't have to do an overlay. You could do an integrated system straight into the display and just run a Crestnet or an AMX signal up into it. So,
right. I mean, we may be entering the phase of, I used to make this joke way back in the day of, there were certain devices coming out, and I was like doing the little Intel 3-note, 4-note thing going, you know, Crestron inside.
Yeah.
You know, you may be getting to that point where the manufacturing really becomes a licensing thing, which is enormously valuable.
Yeah, and kind of cool.
I don't know how employment-centric it is, but it is a valuable, valuable asset.
Ah, employment. That's just overrated.
Yeah, who needs that stuff? Just give me my Soma.
Jeez. Engadget has a story about 4K. Well, 4K. It's like the THX thing. Oh, no. That's Werenberg. That's a theater here in St. Louis. 4K and 1080p, get ready for it, another device that from the Mobile World Congress. Aptina, I think is how you pronounce it. But they're pushing 1080p and 4K into your cell phone. So
yep.
You and I were very, very, very blessed to be a part of a 4K special that we did for CE Pro, right?
Yeah.
One of the things that these guys that we were all talking about on that special was the lack of content. So you have a handheld device that's doing 4K. Are you kidding me? One of the things that the reason I bring this up is the fact that suddenly not only do you have 4K content for these displays, but you have it in such a fashion that we've already talked about, which is the handheld individual media consumption device, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how is that going to help? I mean, how can that do anything but help the proliferation and the pushing from the consumer side for more and more 4K displays?
You know, I'm torn on that statement. Okay. You get into the YouTube effect of, yeah, does it really matter if I'm seeing cats playing pianos in 4K? Okay,
yes.
It might. Yeah, well, okay.
They're four times as cute, or twice as cute.
They're four times as cute, and they're three-dimensional. Yes. There you go.
Well, no,
if you're viewing it on the standard definition, then it is four times as cute, I think. Do the math. I don't know. Carry the one, divide by pi. I don't know. So, you're absolutely correct. And you know what? When I was looking at this, I didn't really start to think about that angle of it. And it's true. This is sort of a YouTube effect for 4K. Mm-hmm. If you're producing your own content in a native 4K, you will start to slowly notice the difference and go, why can't I watch TV in 4K when all of my videos are in 4K that I took of Bobby running down the hill and smashing into a tree? But the blood was just so red. It was vivid. You ever notice that there's going to be a side that horror movies are never at the leading edge of any real high-definition technology?
There's a reason for that.
Maybe 3D was, but then it was in black and white with Vincent Price and all that stuff. And go away. That's two shows in a row I've been able to mention Vincent Price. Thank you.
A native of St. Louis, but go ahead.
There you go. So it is only doing it at 30 frames per second, which I know there's a lot of debate among people who are smarter than I am about what rate the video needs to be at for 4K to really make it stand out and be worth the while. But they claim it will go up to 96 frames per second for 1080p. I'd like to see it first. But this would be something really cool that even that would get me to the Mobile World Congress shows just to see that thing happen.
You mean the fact that it's in Madrid wouldn't?
Well, you know, now that you mention it.
Now that you mention it. Yes.
Special reporter for Aviation?
Yes. The year
how
after.
Was the show? The sun's lovely.
The mimosas are great.
And the food. Did I mention the food?
Jeez. All right. Our buddies over at Electronic House. This was a new one on me. I don't have a projector in my home. I think I've mentioned I have a TV. So, and in my head, because I work and breathe and live in education, I just assume that people who hung projectors in their homes, they hung the projectors. So here's the title of the story. It's called Home Theater Projectors Ready to Expose Themselves. And before you get all prudish on me, chill out. apparently,
that's where I went.
That's, yeah, I know that's where you went. you were just a prude.
Yeah, well,
is the soffit, and be, not to be simplistic, but a lot of times when people do put projectors in their homes, they want to cover them up. You know, they don't want this big bulky thing being shown. And this Lisa Montgomery writes about the change, honestly, in design, and it's you know, the industrial design of projectors has changed over the last few years from being, you know, the Yugo size 3-gun projector from the 1990s on up to
know him
today.
Well. Know him well.
Yeah, unfortunately, so do I.
Do you remember trying to focus those things?
Uh-huh.
Wing nuts and trying to converge them and yeesh.
Yeah. Trying to get, yeah, all 3 guns together. No, thank you.
Back in the day when we used your hands for protection.
Jeez. And the and the focus was actually done up at the projector site with actual, you know, either thumb screws or some other. Yeah. Not these kids nowadays that get to sit back in their chair with their little remote control and do. So, anyway, so that we have come from that to, I'm not going to quite say Apple-ish design because they're not quite that sexy, but they have gotten quite quite stylish, especially compared to the old Barcos. So, George, are we ready for the projector to be part of the home, or are the interior designers and the architects still a bit too prudish when it comes to design and too particular, and they're going to keep throwing the projectors into soffits or some other hiding device?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that the debate between the designers with the, oh, too many bumps on the wall, and the economies of scale of, all right, you need an entire ventilation system that retrofits back onto itself, and it will air cool and, you know, make potable water in the process. I think that now that they're not these boxy things, you're absolutely right. First of all, the electronics are small enough that we can actually make these stylish things. Back a couple of years ago, you had to have these massive boards, but they've been able to reduce them now and get the outputs, especially with single gun projectors, to a level where you can start to be stylish with them. I think that also was a lot with touchscreens. It had a similar thing for many years. You know, it was a touchscreen. It was cool, but the electronics needed to be semi-boxy. Now, hey, we can do this. But there is that big debate. If I have a media room and it's a relaxed environment, that's, for me, pretty cool. If it's a nice-looking projector, I'm going to hang it out front. It doesn't matter. I'm not going to spend any extra money for this ventilation and cooling system, especially when these projectors are quiet with their fans. In fact, I'm sure many of them are probably much quieter than my Dell XPS. Oof, that thing has a bad fan. But, sorry, Dell. That being said, if it's a very fancy home theater, if I'm going to the work to have, you know, nice edging, and I'm doing treated fabrics on the walls, and it's a theater-like environment, recreating some of those, you know, early 20th century movie theaters, I'm going to hide it from a pure design point. It's just, you want to be in that realm where you remember the old projection streaming through the dust and projecting onto a screen for me.
Okay, and I can see that, but I guess, you know, part of it would also be, you're building a home theater, and if the guy has anything to say about it, I guess it's like, you know what, I want this piece of machinery seen, because, you know, it's like seeing your AV receiver, you know. I don't know.
And there's a theory there. There's people who expose it, say in media rooms, and they have a really nice amp, like the high end audiophile guys will show off the Macintoshes. But I've seen a lot of installs where the Macintoshes are installed, but they're in an electronics closet or electronics basement, hidden away. Yeah, they'll take them down and pass the wine cellar, and, you know, hey, well, before we get the wine, look at these, you know, this equipment. It's my pride and joy. But they're hiding those as well. So it's all, I think, really based on what you're going for in that room, and, you know, the tussle with the designer.
Silly people.
You people don't hide. Who needs them?
You don't put Macintosh in a corner. sorry. You sent me this, and it's kind of interesting. It's touted as the most powerful remote in the world.
In the world.
It's your cell phone. It's your iPhone, actually. It's Beacon, right? And Beacon. This is something we've talked about before where...
Not Bacon, Beacon.
Beacon. I do like Beacon. what it is,
call it bacon. Everyone would want it.
Everyone would want it, and we would be in short supply. So it's another story altogether. You've got a device here that basically it's an IR emitter, right, for various devices, and it's controlled by your iPhone. So, George, is this kind of where we're going when it comes to, you know, this is the next generation of the Harmony remote, right? This is the next generation of the Universal.
Yeah, you know, it's a very good point. You think touch panels are in danger from the second screens of iPads and stuff. The Universal Remote IR Blaster systems and manufacturers have to be very concerned about this stuff because this is something that proves it. I mean, first it talks Bluetooth, I believe, is what it talks over to get to the blaster, and then the blaster does its business. And it has awesome screens. I mean, all right, I know the GUI guys and the guys on our control program or show, Will, a state of control, would probably go after me with hatchets for saying that the GUI design is excellent. But for the screen and the screenshots they're showing, it looks pretty darn good. Yeah. And for a novice or a one-time person, hey, I just want to buy it, get it off the shelf at Best Buy, man, that's going to look pretty to me, and it's going to convince me to go with you.
Well, here's the other thing. You say the novice. I say, you know, my dad, and I use my dad a lot because my dad's in his 60s. He's not very technically, adept. And he could take this and within a couple of minutes have everything done.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that makes it nice. Now, yes, the gentleman who is on our state of control, which thank you for mentioning that, we have a brand new control show about control programming in the world of AV. Hosted by myself and our buddy Steve Greenblatt. Go to avnation.tv now and check it out. It's actually quite good. You've got, good Lord, I stopped counting at like 200 people here on, I think. Everything from Abex, who I've never heard of, to Zonda, who I've also never heard of. But I mean, these are the type of manufacturer they've already have built in. And this is a relatively new product. Give them a couple years to develop and mature, and holy cow, you know, they're going to have an awful lot in their arsenal, and they're going to be very dangerous, not just to the harmonies of the world, but also to, you know, not the high-end residential system, and this is not going to take over in boardrooms by any stretch of the imagination, but...
You know, don't be so sure of that.
Really?
You know, a startup boardroom for a startup? You know, they're going to go, hey, what's the easiest thing for me to get? Hey, this will do it. Fine. Will it be the best solution for them? No. And don't everybody start yelling at me.
No, but it won't.
I think I've got Greenblatt already ready to go after me at Infocom. What do you mean a GUI looks nice? But, you know, there are startups who say this is the solution. It's inexpensive. We'll use it for a while. And then they'll start to step up. You know, my concern about this thing, though, is how do you update it with new devices? If they don't have a device, what's the device library update like? I'm not sure. But if you watch the video on the page, the Griffin Technology page, you show this little girl. She's trying to surprise her dad by getting rid of the remotes and blah, blah, blah. But she has to go. They actually show her like going through several screens to get to the control. And that is the one stumbling stone for everyday use that sort of stops me. It has to be tactile. You can't have to look at it and go through three screens.
And see, that's where I somewhat disagree with you. We had I was going through some old notes the other day, and we had Randy Klein on about a year ago, and we were talking about the proliferation of, and Randy Klein is the executive vice president of Crestron. We were talking about the proliferation of tablets and things just this exact same problem, and he made the comment. He said, "You know what? I have it on my iPad." He goes, and when I'm sitting in bed at night, big deal. I can do this, that, and the other. He goes, but if I'm sitting and I'm reading something on my iPad, I don't want to have to get out of that to turn the TV off or to turn the lights off and this, that, and the other. And I get that. But I think there are more people like this little girl in this video than there are people like you and me and Randy who, it's not a big deal for them to flip a page. Or to get out of the video they're watching to change the channel or what have you. I could be definitely wrong. I'm just thinking that the trade-off there is, you have a $100 universal remote versus a $15,000 Crestron system. Which one are you going to choose?
Well, I mean, what will really take it is if this thing can start to do two-way communications in some respects, Can they keep it simple enough and inexpensive enough to expand the system out to, say, taking in HVAC or, you know, environmental information, yeah, or combining that with, say, a Zigbee transmitter as well that then talks to the Zigbee light switches and stuff? Maybe you have something bigger that's even more of a threat to the established larger scale systems. But until then, it's still a nice little way. But see, again, you said, I don't know. I can't, the whole having to go back to that screen and do that to change the channel. And I don't know, who am I? I don't watch TV. I watch about an hour of TV a week. Yeah. So what do I know?
Well, I think that, you know, you got a point there. If they could get in bed with somebody like Zigbee or like, you know, Lutron with the wireless internet devices, mm-hmm, that they've got, and you, obviously the Nest thermostat thing, they would have something even more killer. So, speaking of watching TV an hour a week, Nielsen. Nielsen are the people who tell the advertisers how much you watch TV and what you watch. They are going to start monitoring and rating web TV. Now, why does this matter? About 2005, the viewing hours in the U.S. peaked. Let me say that part again. 2005 is when the viewing hours of the United States viewing public peaked.
Mm.
That means that since 2005, it has not been higher. It has gone down. We are on the internet. That's all we do, right? We don't have a brick and mortar broadcast station. We don't have a radio tower. We don't have a transmitter by any stretch of the imagination. The internet is our transmitter. And so that's why stories like this matter to us specifically, but also to you, because this means that more and more we're going to have to start getting more and more wired systems together, right? Things like the Roku and things like making sure that the Xbox or the Wii or what have you is even more and more integrated into the systems that you do. Right now, they're going to start, you know, basically monitoring and rating what you guys watch on TV. And George, is this something where, first of all, did you expect this already? I mean, did you expect it by 2013, or did you maybe think maybe it was going to be another 5 or 10 years before we got here?
I'm actually shocked it hasn't been happening since. I mean, yeah, I'm sure that YouTube and Google is tracking via, yeah, if you've got a Google account and you're tied in, they know what you're watching. I think this is sort of one of those stunners that, really, you're doing that? When the Janet Jackson thing happened and TiVo reported like 3 or 4 hours after it, saying it was the single most revisited or reviewed show TiVo had ever witnessed. And everyone went, wow, TiVo tracks that?
Yeah.
And like, you know, it was one of those dawning moments for me, like, yeah, of course they do. That makes sense. If they can send me ads, they can actually see what I'm watching.
Yes.
You know, I mean, thank goodness pay-per-view doesn't do that, but at least through TiVo. But I think it's, you have to do it because everything's moving there anyway. And this fight between the free internet and the whole throttling, and the business is saying it's a business tool now, not just the free-for-all anarchy that was the coder's delight. There has to be some kind of metricing of it because everybody wants to make money on it, and they're still debating on how ROI and making money on the web is going to really work in advertising. This is one giant step towards making that a solid thing, definitely.
It is. And don't misunderstand, they're not going to rate, whether they redo that, I really liked Arrested Development on Netflix. They're not gonna see how much time you spent watching SNL on Hulu. They will, though, monitor how long you spend on Hulu, right? And yeah, so they'll be able to track that as well. So
I think they'll actually track how long you watch SNL and how many episodes in a row.
Yeah, eventually they will.
Binge and marathon. And I mean, all that stuff's important to them because if there's producers now, I forget which one I heard it about, but on NPR they were talking to a bunch of content producers in which they produce the content specifically for marathoners, people who line up, and I forget what show it was, who released all the episodes at once.
House of Cards,
okay. Yeah, and they Kevin specifically Spacey. For that. Okay, yeah. They specifically did it for that. So it's changing. So they're going to know, are you a marathoner? Fine, we're going to find a way to fine-tune how we present ads to you or where that is done, or does this show in marathon mode, you know, 90% of the people watch it in marathon mode. So the advertisings have to be product placement within the actual context of the show.
No, yeah, and that makes
right? sense. Because they're going to just skip through. If you're not, then they're going to produce and send you some additional ads in between episodes, at the beginning or at the end, mostly at the beginning probably. Sort of like the old DVD thing where you can't get past the menu. What do you mean I can't go forward? Which really irritated me. But, again, not shocked, surprised it hasn't happened yet. Surprised it's not already happening, which I think we'll hear is actually true.
And I think it's, I honestly think it's a good thing that it's happening because, you know, the more we can get into, how do I put this? The more, a little bit less Wild West about the internet would be a good thing. Because then you could have quality programming that people are willing to put money into because then they can get a return on their investment, the Arrested Development and like the House of Cards.
Well, even YouTube is doing their own content. They're hiring people to do professional and semi-professional content.
Well, they had, last year they had the channel initiative where they spent $100 million. They hired out 100 people at $1 million apiece. Everybody from Shaq to Martha Stewart to Felicia Day. If you're not familiar with Felicia Day, just go to Geek and Sundry. It's really cool. Will Wheaton from Star Trek The Next Generation has a show on there called Tabletop, which is totally geeky. And it's just him and three other people, usually celebrities of some level, playing board games. Right. And these are not, he's not playing Monopoly. He's just, you know, this is stuff like Ticket to Ride is one. The Sands of Catan, I think, or the Fields of Catan are another. And just these really cool board games. So, anyhow.
Well, look, I mean, YouTube actually had an upfront last year. Now, I'm not sure if they've done one prior to that, but if you don't know what an upfront is, it's where the broadcast network brings in two shows, usually, an advertising set. Everybody who's part of the advertising set saying, this is what we're going to be selling this year. Here's how the episodes plays out. Here's some previews for you. And they generate a lot of buzz about it. And then they bring in the broadcasters. And in YouTube's case, they probably won't. But usually for a traditional broadcast, they bring in the broadcast affiliates and say, this is what we're doing. Here's what we're selling your advertisers. And, you know, it's going to be a great season, blah, blah, blah. They actually did an upfront. Wow. That shows that they really have a major foothold in this and that they are looking for this to become a real network, at least in the streaming online stuff. We know that Netflix is producing some original content. I know that Hulu
as well. Yeah.
Yeah. This is really the rise of the second screen in the streaming and they're all trying to get on board, but it's going to be interesting.
It's another stick. A stick is a transmitter. So
yes.
All right. From Technology Tell, actually, I asked George about this company right before we got on the air. Monoprice is introducing the IR over HDMI. IR over HDMI. I don't know about, you know, who Monoprice is. I'm sure they're very fine people. George, is this a product that was, is this fitting a need or is this just, hey, we can do it, so let's do it?
Yes. I think both those motivations are there. Hey, look, Monoprice is the dirty little secret of the AV industry. We all know it. If you know who they are, you know you've been using them. Maybe for not everything, but man, oh man, are they everywhere. In fact, just a short aside, it looks like they're starting getting into equipment, and some of it's fairly professional looking. I'll reserve comment as to whether or not it really stands up to professional broadcast standards, but they're not joking around here, and I like to call Monoprice the monster cable without the attitude.
I can see that.
Or the vitriol. But they are sort of a guilty pleasure, and they are giving you this thing that, well, look, why are we surprised that IR is over HDMI?
Because of CEC.
Right, well, but why are we surprised by it? Because they don't make it work, these yabos that establish the standard. You know, you read the HDMI spec.
They're not Yahoos. They're very smart computer people that just don't have a darn idea about what AV is about. But go ahead.
Well, but then again, also the manufacturers say, yes, we'll agree to do that. And, you know, I've gone off on my MIDI rant. Follow the MIDI example, you people, and you'll get it to work. This should be capable. You should be able to have it talk to a device either over HDMI and control it or convert it to IR. It's not really rocket science. So if you have this extra spigot and it will let you do this, I think this is a brilliant idea because you're not running as many cables anymore and you don't need the IR blaster and you don't need, you know, this little thin wire that's tracing up anywhere. It's going to go on that native path. Is it right for everybody? No, but it really is a nifty little product that goes, oh, I can do that. And that's, of course, what they're either the lost leader or the Trojan horse idea where you like that piece. Look at all this other stuff we do. You know, you want a receiver? We sell receivers.
They sell a lot of stuff, actually.
I went to a website.
When I read the article, I'm like, oh, wow, okay, cool. So,
from the integration or I'm surprised you in education don't know about them because they do sell those little mini display port to DVI-I and DVI-D and DVI-A. They actually make individual ones. You can get, you know, standard display port, mini display port. You can get these great Ethernet cables that are darn inexpensive. And, I buy them all the time for what I'm doing in-house at least. They make great cables, and we've never had a problem with them. I mean, we do media server stuff, and man, oh man, do these cables stand up to the test of time. And we're unracking and re-racking and tying them in and untying them in and moving them across the country. And, knock on wood, we haven't had an issue with them yet.
Well, the other thing from an integration standpoint is they sell label-less cables, you know. Mm-hmm. So when you go into a bid meeting and you've got, you know, X amount of dollars for cabling, and they say, you know, what's the name of your cable? There isn't one. It's Bob's AV systems. They're my cables. You know, it's stuff that we have specially made. And so people can't take that then and then shop it around and compare it. From an integration standpoint, I get, you know, that's actually a kind of a cool thing. So, okay, joining us now is Mr. Harry Mead. Yay! He is the CTS Enterprise Level Project Manager for Vision Technology Services. How are you, sir?
Pretty good. How are you?
Doing well.
Although, Tim.
Yes.
He is a CTSD.
Oh, bite me.
See, I put that on my bio, but I wasn't gonna hold him to it. If he was having a problem where he couldn't say CTSD
I
after
said
my
it.
Name.
You're coming up on your 2-year anniversary, by the way.
Yes, I know.
And the only reason I know that is because Harry took the CTSD same day I did. He's a CTSD, and I'm not. That's all I'm going to say about that. All right, Harry, we're going to talk about home automation, control systems. How about that? Something you know something about. The story comes to us from DSI Entertainment Systems, and the basic premise is this. Tomato, tomato, systems integration, home control systems, home automation, smart home, quote unquote. It's the same thing. Harry? Is it the same thing?
It depends.
You're about as positive as George is.
I'm positive George is just fine on this. yes, it all depends on what your definition of is. The Everybody has jumbled all the terms up so much that they really don't mean anything, yet they all mean the same thing, which is basically taking everything and making it easier for an end user to use.
Okay.
And so, whether that's...
Go ahead.
Yeah, whether that's a all-in-one remote from the Radio Shack... all the way up through Crestron AMX with touch panels and lots of whiz-bang, that's basically what it boils down to. It's just how much you want to do.
All right, George, so maybe if we're trying to make it easy for the end user, couldn't we all just call it the same darn thing?
Well, I don't know. I want to call Radio Shack Best Buy Lite, so let's just start there.
Okay.
They're no longer Radio Shack.
No, they're not.
You know
the
what?
Shake Shack's a shack.
I can still get a soldering iron from my local Radio Shack, so it's still a Radio Shack.
Yeah, after the sales guy goes, so what? Hold on, I got to go look in stock. Manager?
No, I don't ask them anymore. I just go straight to them.
Oh, there you go.
I know what
they are. You can get a soldering iron, but you can't actually do anything with it because there's no parts for you to use.
Well, there is that. There is that. Go ahead.
God, we are like the sarcastic twins. I love it. just make him. It's all warm and fuzzy right here. Just the cockles of my heart. Here's my distinction. Here's my distinction. Home automation is basically your lights, your AV system, and maybe some other little other stuff. A smart home to me is one that can also interact with your environmental controls and give you feedback about what its usage is. In that sense, the smart home is telling me, I'm going to, do they still use the word shedding when they talk about lighting, you know, bringing down power for lighting when it's overused or there's too much demand or something? I think they still use that term. They have some fancy term that's like 18 syllables nowadays, but kids today. But that to me is the definition of smart homes, is that when it gives you this information back about the environment's action, reaction, and stability, then it's a smart home to me because it knows when I'm walking in the room that I want it to do a certain thing. Home automation to me is I touch a button, the windows close, the screen comes down, the TV goes to my favorite channel. But a smart home will say, ah, George, you're home. I sense it from your phone or your RFID tag or whatever it is that we use. And we're going to put the nice mellow music jazz on. We're going to dim the lights a little bit. And we're going to bring the temperature up to 72.
Ooh, I have an even better one. It monitors your tweets all day. And if it can tell you're in a good mood, it plays, you know, punk. If it determines you're in a bad mood, it plays jazz.
There you go. All very doable even today, actually.
Somebody should take that and go make $1 million with it. All right.
Dave, I have your music ready.
Good morning or good evening, Dave.
Oh, what was the 80s movie about a computer that takes over? It was like I'm going to have to find it for the notes now. It was like an 1980s or early 90s movie about a guy who gets a computer and it becomes sentient and gets him in trouble with a girl next door.
There was an awful lot of those over in the 80s. Everything from Blade Runner to...
Yeah, no, this was like, you know, like modern day, present time, 90s.
You've described half the movies of the 80s.
Yeah. Johnny Five, what was it, Short Circuit.
Short Circuit.
War Games. Weird Science. Oh, Weird Science. Okay, moving on. Sorry, I had a Kelly LeBrock moment. From Life Hacker.
Ooh, hey now.
Picking the 5 best AV receivers. George, I'm going to let you drive this one because I just recently purchased my first receiver ever in my life. So this is not something that I know a whole lot. I mean, I know what they do and all this jazz. And I have a lot of respect for Yamaha and Denon. A couple of these I don't really know that much about. But when you're going out and you're looking for an AV receiver, we're going to talk about this and also lead this into how to get a soundbar and why you would want to get one. But when you're getting a receiver, what are you looking for?
Well, I mean, let me turn the question around for a minute. Why did you buy one?
Honestly, I had too many HDMI sources and not enough ports on my TV. So I'm serious.
Well, that's one answer, right, Harry? I mean, that's the first one. I need to put a lot of gazingas into one gazauka.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I needed a switcher.
Yes, exactly. But I needed a switcher that had volume control.
Yeah.
And that maybe let me play a little bit with the Dolby feed or the surround sound feed and somewhat tune that to the room, given different models that have stuff. I mean, there's a couple of them in here, actually, that even have, like, the Odyssey inside. I mean, remember earlier we were talking about how some of these smartphones might have, you know, the Crestrunner AMX inside for their workings. This is sort of happening on this end with the receivers as well. So I think most people listening at this point know what a receiver does or why it's there. These are, and I love this that Life Hacker's getting into it, because normally they talk about cobbling disparate technology together to create something that helps you with your life or at least is fun. This is a big step because these are important if you're going to do a media room. Again, we talked about home theaters versus media rooms. This is like the media room. You know, this is the essential component for a media room besides a TV and a speaker and a something to give you content. Because if you're going to do a DVD and a cable, you need a receiver. I'm sorry, don't use the standard inputs because it's just going to cause you problems. You know, I'd ask Harry, you guys must put in a lot of these things, no?
Well, now that I'm in the corporate enterprise world, I don't touch any of them.
So go back to your past life, my friend.
I was going to say, in past life, I was in corporate, too, so I haven't done Resi, like, ever.
Really? No, but even in like government, you know. No, I guess
no, not. They're going to use the switcher and separate stuff. It's true. So for the home, I'm going to take it over again then.
I was going to say I can talk about mine and what I did. I was actually looking at the article. I was actually surprised at what all they do now.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I got my receiver back in the day,
it was steam powered. Oh.
And it clacked, and you had to wear goggles.
Harry was the original steampunk.
Welder's goggles.
It has a couple of component inputs on it, because that was the hip, happy thing. This was before HD, really. And a crap ton of S-video and composite inputs. Mm-hmm. And it's got the speaker out, and it's got the radio and that sort of stuff. And the reason that I got the one that I got was because it had a 232 port on it that I could control.
Mm-hmm.
And now it looks like all of these are probably IP controllable.
Yep. And did you look at sort of like even the Yamaha or the... They mentioned a Yamaha unit here, which has Rhapsody, which has... Pandora, which has all these kind of app capabilities. It's sort of the smart TV for audio in a way. You can actually,
Pandora's becoming the village bicycle. It's everywhere.
Yeah, it is. It is. But it has like the Yamaha RX-V, it's called, right? RX-V. They have AirPlay, native AirPlay. I mean, that's pretty darn cool stuff within this one box that helps you interconnect all your disparate sources. And you can control them and move them around. And some of the more advanced ones, like I have an old Pioneer one that doesn't let me put music from my DVD player into the kitchen and my TV to the TV. But some of these newer ones let you split those channels out, let you separate things and say, they want to listen to this in the kids' room, but I want to watch the show here. It lets you do that all from that one central controlled unit.
Yeah, and I mean, I've just been amazed by how IP everything has become, and it's just a lot of these had different streaming applications, like you said, AirPlay, that sort of thing, and kind of tying this into the smart home discussion, I downloaded an app for my phone and used it to mess with AV Dawn.
Why'd you do that?
Because it's fun. It's a remote control for my DirecTV receiver. And if my phone is on my Wi-Fi network, it can find the DirecTV receiver that is also on the network and control it.
And then you change channels and...
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I was messing with her. She was on the guide. Oh, it was wonderful. But
so, Harry, at this point, are you walking with a limp? I just have to ask.
No. Are you walking?
No, because I run faster than she does. But the other thing that it did, and one of the things that I'm researching, this was all this week. One of the things I'm researching this weekend is that means there's IP control commands for this particular receiver, which means that has to be published somewhere, which means I will find it and I will incorporate it into my home cobbled together AMX system, and then I don't have to worry about IR blasters or anything else,
or 232 depending on what kind of thing you've got. Yeah, absolutely. That's actually quite cool.
And then you can mess with Miss AV Dawn remotely from anywhere in the world.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Oh, why do you encourage him? All right. Let's actually talk about, a little bit more on home AV stuff. I've never had much love for soundbars, and this is the reason why. You've got, I understand, that they have kind of been born out of the necessity of the fact that as displays get thinner and thinner and thinner, the speakers get smaller and smaller and smaller, right? Because they don't have any place to put them anymore. It was a time, I think we talked about this a little earlier, when we have we had console TVs, right? Well, then you could put a freaking 18-inch cone in the back of the console TV and have no problems at all hearing things. Well, now that displays have gotten thinner and thinner, you don't have that capability, and so we have a soundbar. Reason is this, and the fact that you've got very well-intentioned manufacturers. Some of them are the same companies that make the displays. Some of them are not. But they're saying, hey, you've got this pretty thin little TV. Here, throw another piece of junk on top of it or underneath it, right? I get the need from them. I'm just, I'm a little jaded when it comes to why you would throw more stuff on top of it. The article, though, is from Digital Trends. And Harry, when it comes to, I guess, getting a less obtrusive soundbar, let's start that. What's some of the things that people should want to look for?
It depends, because I'm not that big a fan of some of what the soundbars do. So, it all boils down to sound quality for me. Because you can run signal to any speaker and get sound out of it. You just need to, hear what it's actually going to sound like. And if you're going to want to sit in front of that television for a few hours with whether it sounds like a couple of tin cans with string, or whether it sounds nice and there's actually full sound, whether some of them mentioned subwoofers with them, which I would wholeheartedly support, so that you actually have more full range sound. Mm-hmm. Some of them talked about faked up surround sound, which I've never been that big of a fan of the acoustic trickery to make surround sound. I'd rather have actual speakers with actual channels coming from the actual directions where they're supposed to be coming from.
Crazy talk.
I know. Get off my lawn. Because that just strikes me as more. I go into the Bose shop in the mall, and they have, that's all they have is faked up. Here, you can have surround sound out of this small 6-inch cube.
Hey, you can watch TV on a 7-inch screen now that you can carry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, but you need all these speakers to go with it in order to sound right. Basically, what I would look for would be, to go rambling back to the point, would be inputs, because, again, from the article I was looking at, they had different types of either usually digital inputs, so you have less less cabling going between, and also a few of them had HDMI in, so that, again, it's all just a single cable going in and out, which works well for you're just trying to set up something and you got to make it work.
And that makes sense.
Yeah,
George, if you were to advise someone on getting a soundbar, what would you say?
Well, I think Harry makes some great points in that, first of all, the idea is, what are you going to use it for? Is it a great center channel? And when you don't have room to put something that is a bit bigger and get that center channel out in a 5.1, 7.1 system, sure, it's great. If you're looking for it to fill the room like you're in the stadium, no, it's not going to do it. And I'm with you, Harry, on the psychoacoustic thing. For I live in a 1901 Colonial. I don't have a spare room which I can make a media room. So I look at these kind of sound bars and stuff as something I can mount away from the wall, away from the kids' hands, up there, in addition of, mounted sort of on the side. I don't have real surround set in my house at this point, because they used to, and the kids went, "Ooh, look at that, it moves, poke." yeah, it was nice. but it's to an end and to a purpose, and there are gradations of quality in that, like anything else. Even our friend John, I always get his name wrong. Saki, I never get his name
Siaka?
Siaka. I don't know what it is, John. I'm sorry. John Siaka wrote a really interesting blog post about soundbars and how he's grown to love them. And maybe not think they're the greatest things ever, but they are a sales tool and they are something to say, we can make this work and add on to it as well, that they have a purpose. You can't really fight it anymore, just sort of like saying you need a dedicated touchscreen. You may not. And in those instances, the soundbar is about how much power you need. Do you think you're going to want to upgrade later? And where is it going to be situated? And if it's in a really large room, this may not happen. But if it's in a small living room, media room, they may actually be very beneficial to a large percentage of people putting in this sort of cobbled together high-end, low-end system. The purist will probably curse my name to the high heavens about it, but it's there. It's a good purpose, and it's not going away.
Yeah. All right. Last but not least, this article says four reasons not to put your TV above a fireplace. I'll give you one, because you're not supposed to freaking do it. I'm sorry. George, why am I not supposed to put my TV next to my fireplace?
Let me think. Fire.
Fire and electronics is fire bad.
TV pretty.
A TV made of plastic. And it will burn. Or melt at least. Good night.
Wait a minute, though. You know, and the premise of the article is, don't do this.
Yeah.
But the point is that, first of all, most fire codes require that the wall from the chimney needs to have a certain amount of distance from the actual chimney so that there's not direct contact from the heat. Like in the old days, we just put plaster up against the brick and send it up on its way. So it's not nearly as bad as that. My biggest thing about this is not just the heat, but it's the how high up do I have to look? I've even seen this without the fireplace. Let's even get rid of the fireplace for a minute. People mounting these panels so high up over a faux mantelpiece or...
Yeah.
Why? Do you feel like you need to watch the TV like you're in a rocket?
No, they want to feel like they're in the front row of the theater. Of a movie theater.
Of an IMAX theater.
Yeah.
The sight range is always bad. Although I have to admit... And it's knifing my own heart to say this. I saw a good use of this over the weekend.
Okay.
I know.
Continue.
So I was looking at a model home just because I do that occasionally just to see what's going on. And it was kind of an open concept room that had like had the kitchen facing a kind of open little informal eating area facing into a little seating area with a little fireplace. And then up above that, probably a good bit above that, was like a might have been a 40, maybe. Might have even been in the 30s, 30-inch TV. In that case, that room is not designed for people to be watching the TV. That TV is for the people in the kitchen area while they're prepping.
Okay. And they're not going to be sitting down, and the angle will be much smaller. And
exactly. So that worked. And that's the only instance that I've seen where it would work. At my house, I have vents on my fireplace that actually suck the cold air from the sides and put it out a vent above the fireplace. It actually heats the air and puts it back into the room. Anything I put up there gets melted.
Yep.
I made the mistake of putting a Christmas decoration up there 1 year. That apparently used hot glue.
Oh, jeez. how long did it last?
About an hour and a half after I started a fire. I'm like, what is going on? There's pieces falling off of that wreath.
It's like a guy with a toupee in a tropical forest on an August day.
Yes. Yeah. So I couldn't put anything up there if I wanted to, because it wouldn't last but a day or two. Aside from the fact that the sight lines are just trash.
Yeah. Wow. Well, now that we've solved that problem.
Do we have time to talk about the six strikes?
Yeah, sure. What the heck? We'll talk about it.
I mean, look, if you have to cut out some other stuff or cut this part out. I want to hear Harry talk on this. This is what I want to hear.
Okay.
This is why I came to this bar, to hear this man talk about this thing.
Jeez, wow. All right. Well, here it goes. We've got one more story. Here's the thing, guys. We've talked about piracy enough on this show, and other people have talked about it, you know, who are smarter than me by any stretch of the imagination. But what we've got is a situation where, well, your ISP is going to basically spy on you more than they have been. Or maybe not more than they have been, but it'll be a little more blatant about it now.
They're going to admit to it.
They're going to admit to it, yeah. And you've got a thing where the six strikes is where you, the first two or three, they'll give you a nice little warning, a nice little email, maybe even a voicemail or a phone call saying, hey, we noticed that you downloaded or uploaded some copywritten material. If you could not do that again, that would be great. Thanks. Appreciate it. Have a nice day. Love, Comcast, or, you know, Time Warner, or whoever your ISP is. And I believe the fourth or fifth one, they will shut you off for a little bit. Or they'll throttle you. They'll throttle your bandwidth. So, you know, almost like a warning type thing. And then finally they'll, you know, shut you off completely and ban you for life and turn you into the feds. So, Harry, we'll start with you on this one. Are these guys within their rights to do this, and do we have any recourse on the matter?
I am torn. While I hate all of this piracy stuff, I think it's completely overblown. I think that it is complete and utter intrusion into what you're trying to do, to the point where we can't rip our own DVDs. It is, the ISPs are not public.
True.
Okay.
They are privately held companies.
They are privately held companies, and they give you a spigot onto the internet. The libertarian in me says they can do whatever they want with that spigot.
True.
And if you don't want to do it, find a different spigot. However, the non-interference part of me is like, these guys, there are going to be so many false alarms on things. I mean, I could rack up six strikes in about a half an hour or less on YouTube.
Yeah.
Okay. So there are, it's so nebulous. What it goes back to is it's so nebulous on the whole copyright issue and who owns what and how long you should own it. And it keeps, the copyright keeps getting longer and longer and longer and longer. I saw an interesting thing that back when they first came up with copyright laws, back when the country was founded, it was, I probably have the numbers wrong, but it was something like 10 years. And then it was public domain.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're up to 70, and there's going to be pushes to put it to 90
years. And that's 70 after the person dies.
Yeah.
So So it's the life of the person plus 70 years.
Yes. So.
And that's general. I mean, there are other, you know, there's, you know, if you make it for somebody else, you know, there are other, there's limits on that. And so.
The estate clause.
No.
It's just gotten, completely out of hand. It's like, okay, yes, I agree. You put a lot into it, and if you can't make your money back in the first bid, I'll give you longer than 10 years. That's fine, but even at 70 years, even life plus 70 years at this point, for me, hopefully, that is 100 years from now. Mm-hmm. That is it's still copyrighted, and it's still people are going to get in trouble if they use my work, and it's like that just seems very, very wrong to me. It's like, okay, I get you need some copyright, but you don't need it to go in perpetuity.
No. George, is Harry right? This is more of a copyright issue than a technology and a piracy issue.
Yeah, I'm torn as well. It's sort of like, okay, we need to do something about this because, you know, I'm being a former musician and working with musicians. They're not making money off this stuff. They're putting it out there for free, which has its advantages and disadvantages. We can talk about the C.K. Lewis,
yeah,
you know, how he did that and everything else, but. You know, my solution to this is probably what they should do is what YouTube does. You have on your site copyrighted material. It's not the entire movie, or maybe it's most of it. They start putting ads on your feed that you can't make revenue off of, that usually pushes people towards purchasing the content from its owner. Okay.
Okay.
Do it. Because most of us don't want to buy pirated material. Most of us want to buy something for a fair price, for a fair use. And be able to copy my DVDs to a library so I can put it on my Kaleidoscape and be able to view it in streaming mode and et cetera. But if I'm getting it from BitTorrent or from somebody that I know is nefarious, and you know, you can see that it's, hey, look, you downloaded 52 albums in less than 12 seconds or in a day. Yeah. You're probably not building up your library. You're probably trying to distribute them. And then just start, you know, for the big time guy, you go after him full bore. But for the little guys, like, oh, that kid did this, their feed now becomes a revenue generator for that person and for the provider. And if you don't like it, don't do it.
Yeah, my whole thing is, and I agree with Harry. It's a bigger, it's more a brokenness of our copyright system. And it, Harry, there's been a phrase that I did not coin, but I love an awful lot. It's the Disneyfication of our copyright law. And the reason it's called that is because Walt Disney, the company, is one of the biggest lobbyists every time the copyright length it comes up for debate. And I think currently, if the current law stays in place, Mickey Mouse will go out of copyright in 2015 or 2020. I've lost track at this point.
It's 15.
Is it 15?
Yeah.
And so you've got this company, this multinational corporation, who is one of the biggest five? One of the five biggest media companies in the world, in terms of both, you know, media power plus exactly how much money they're actually making, squeezing the government, saying, hey, look, you know, you have to help us protect our copyright, which is code for you have to help us protect our revenue stream, right? Because what happens when Mickey Mouse goes out of copyright and it becomes public domain? Well, then you have kids on the street selling Mickey Mouse T-shirts, and it's suddenly not illegal to do that, right? Currently, it would be because they'd be violating the copyright, which, if we went by the original copyright that when, you know, the original Walt drew Mickey Mouse, he would have gone out of copyright sometime in the 70s. That's my two cents on it.
Well, but here's the thing. You can create a path for someone to renew the copyright for a obviously – take Mickey Mouse for an example.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they are still actively using and actively marketing things with Mickey Mouse on them. Okay, that company is still around. Of course they are, because they have multiple rat's nests all over the world. However, they are actively using that, so they have a case for a renewal period of the copyright. It should not be forever, but if you are still actively using it and making money off of it, then I would say that yes, you should have a way to renew that copyright. It doesn't need to be a blanket law. I think the blanket law should err on the side of less, and people who need to do an exception should be able to apply for an extension to that copyright.
And see, I err on completely opposite, because then we get into the question of, you know, who owns the copyright, really? It is really kind of what it comes down to. Is it Walt, right? Is Walt the person, the human being, the person with a social security number, right? Is that who owns the copyright? And then what happens when he or she passes away? Or is it the corporation? And if it's a corporation, then I have a bigger problem with it, because now you have an entity that has no expiration date, okay? Not that I'm looking to kill people off. I'm just, you know, that there's a good demarcation line. When someone passes away, that copyright needs to start a countdown when that copyright's going to go out. I understand, you know, corporations build their build their businesses around an individual's copyright and their right to hold on to that, and I get that. I agree with the life of the person plus however many years, and we can debate that later. But transferring that to a corporation, i.e. an entity that will never die, seems like a very, very sticky area to get into when it comes to copyright law. So that's...
Corporations die every day.
Not ones built on mice, though. So...
Well, but here's an argument on the other side of that. How many of the iconic Walt Disney Company icons are Walt Disney's? Okay. Who owns the copyright then on Belle from Beauty and the Beast?
Yeah.
Who owns the copyright on Mufasa from Lion King or Simba? Okay.
Or Snow White.
Snow White, though, was Walt, and he was working on that.
There's actually an answer to that, Harry. The copyright is, if you do it for someone, if you do work for someone, so let's say that I created something for you, Harry. The copyright would be, we both hold the copyright for as long as I lived, plus or minus so many years. I don't think it's quite 70. I think it's a different situation, but there's still a limitation to that, and it's based on the person's life, the person who created it. And so that's where I'm, you know, the more libertarian side of me says, you know what, just stick with the freaking law that we all agreed on. Stop moving the goalpost, right? Stop changing the rules midstream. And once we stop doing that, then we can move forward with reforming, you know, copyright law and reforming all these other things. Then we can continue. Then we can start a conversation about, well, you know what, who owns it? You know, if I buy a DVD, does that mean that I own that, or am I just leasing or renting the right to play that in my home? But until we get this whole stickiness figured out, I don't think that there's really there's not room to play, because they will they keep continually change the rules on us. So,
well, and the ISPs are just they're afraid of the MPAA, and they don't want their content, their paid content, taken away.
They're afraid of Jack Valenti.
Yes.
Okay, he's
going to kneecap him.
Yeah. All right. Last but not least, it's not really something we're going to talk about. Just a moment of silence for Mr. Raymond Cusick, who who is Raymond Cusick? He's the person who gave us the Daleks from Doctor Who. So he passed away this week. So
yes. This show in dedication to Raymond Cusick.
Exterminate! All right. thank you so much for joining us, guys. With us has been Harry Mead. Harry Mead is a CTSD. What does that mean? It means he's better than me.
Damn right.
He's the enterprise-level project manager, Vision Technology Services. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Not a problem. Sorry I had to be late.
How can people find you, get a hold of you, heckle you?
Oh, it's so many ways. Facebook, Harry Mead. Twitter is Mr. AV Dawn, because she got bigger than I did on Twitter.
Watch how you say that, dude. Just never mind. Continue.
That's probably the easiest ways.
Okay. Very good. And also, Mr. George Tucker, the engineering coordinator for World Stage. How can people find you, sir?
If it's social media, just find at Tucker2s and you'll find me.
Very good. If you want to do the Twitter thing for me, it is TD, Tim David Albright, ALBRIGHT. But more importantly for me and everybody here at AV Nation, please go by the website, avnation.tv. AVNation.tv, you'll find this show as well as our education focused show, the social and the live, the DIY show that we do, and the brand spanking new control show that we started up with Steve Greenblatt. A couple of the other regulars, Rich Fregosa is on there. It's called A State of Control. It's all about control programming. So check that out also, if you would please. It all starts at AVNation. AVNation.tv. AVNation.tv. That's all the time we have for AV Week.